Guess what, Yvonne and Raz? I think we have Raz to thank for this because he introduced us to Podbean, and now we have risen all the way to be the Podbean featured podcast of the month.
That's right. This podcast is sponsored by Podbean. Podbean is the easiest way to create your own podcast. And as Steve mentioned, we here at the Great Trials Podcast use Podbean to host our podcast. Raz, that's all thanks to you. Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about Podbean?
Yeah, I love Podbean. I produce a lot of podcasts and I always recommend Podbean because it's easy, it's simple, and the most economical.
I'll say it's very easy for to get on it and track, you know, like how the podcast is doing, who's it getting to, for people to follow. So yeah, it makes it very easy to start your own podcast. So you should download the free Podbean podcast app to start, record, and publish your very own podcast in minutes. Podbean provides everything you need to run your podcast, and you can record and publish episodes directly from the app on your phone. Download the free Podbean app today. That's P-O-D-B-E-A-N.
Check it out, friends.
Just check it out.
Welcome to the Great Trials Podcast, where you get a behind-the-scenes look at America's greatest trials with the trial lawyers who tried them.
These farmers want to be heard, but they are very dignified people and very proud people, and it just kind of emboldened me in fighting for them.
Please rise. Court is now in session.
All right. Welcome to the Great Trials Podcast. This is Steve Lowry with Yvonne Godfrey. Yvonne, how are you doing this afternoon?
I'm good. I thought you were going to lead off with how Raz, our producer, is doing this afternoon.
I know. We were just thinking. So we got big news that we learned just before we started recording the show that Raz is taking the LSAT, not just sometime random in the future, but tomorrow. So we're like Raz, what are you doing recording this when you maybe should be studying? But he sounds like he is completely ready and is going to just nail the LSAT. So we're not worried at all.
If you guys are religious, pray for me.
Right. Yeah, let's start praying right now.
And Raz, before we move on, tell everybody how it's working, how the test administration is working.
Oh yeah, so everything's virtual. So I have to clear out my studio and take the green screen down and the TV off the wall. And they'll scan the room before, and I'm taking it at 8 p.m. actually.
Okay.
8 p.m. And you'll be done by 8:05, right? Right.
No. So you got to you'll have to move the camera around and show them that you don't have anything else in the room with you.
Yep. Correct. Yeah.
Wow.
Yep. Under the desk, in closets, everything.
Wow.
Wow.
And so somebody's basically going to certify this, that your room is clean.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And I'll be on a webcam, and if I leave the webcam, they can cancel the test and everything.
Really? Mm-hmm. Wow. That's crazy. Well, great. Good luck. I know you don't need it because I know you're going to do fantastic.
Yeah. And because you listen to the best lawyers all the time when you're recording our podcast.
That's right.
I never talk about the LSAT, but I definitely listen to you all the time.
at our next podcast, Raz, we will expect an update on how the LSAT went.
Okay. I'll be ready.
All right.
All right. Cool. Let me introduce our guest. We have just a fantastic guest today. We have Greg Francis, who is a partner in the law firm of Osborne and Francis PLLC with offices both in Orlando and Boca Raton. And you can look up Greg at realtoughlawyers.com, realtoughlawyers.com. Greg, that's one of the better website names that we've had on the show. So, good thing you got in there early to make sure you got that.
Right, exactly. No, thank you. That was my idea. My partner will tell you that. And he was a little unsure of it at first, but I knew it would grow on him.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I love it. And it's easy to remember and easy to find. Right. So, much more interesting than our law firm's website, which I think I came up with. So I have nobody to blame. Well, Greg, let me tell everybody a little bit about you. So as I've said already, Greg is a partner in Osborne and Francis down in Florida. He is the Vince Monroe Townsend Legend Award winner by the National Bar Association and has been named as a game changer by Politic 365. Greg is a graduate of the University of Florida for both undergrad and for law school. And just a few things that he has done. One is I know that one lawyer has called you the most successful civil rights attorney that no one knows. So I think that's changing quickly. We're certainly going to do our best to change that. And Greg is active. I mean, a great trial lawyer, been involved in a number of cases and involved civically. He's on the board of trustees for Bethune-Cookman University, on the executive board for the Florida chapter of the National Bar Association, and was the president of the Paul C. Perkins Bar Association from 2001 to 2003. But I think most importantly is that Greg has spent a huge amount of his career working on civil rights, obviously, and working on a case known, there's a few different names for it, but I think it's called In Re Black Farmers or the Pigford versus Glickman cases. I've also seen a complaint that was called Copeland versus Vilsack in the United States Department of Agriculture. And Greg is the author of a book called Just Harvest, the story of how Black farmers won the largest civil rights case against the U.S. government. You can find that book. So one place you can look up Greg is on realtoughlawyers.com, but you can also look up his book and look up Greg at justharvestbook.com. And we're here to talk about the case that is the subject of that book. So, Greg, thank you so much for coming on.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for, you know, allowing me to get this message out about, you know, the plight of the Black farmers and what they've been through.
Yeah. So one of the things that I noticed from your book is that you say right in the beginning that if you read this book, it's a bitter pill to swallow and you won't be able to forget it. And you know, some of the stories that unfold in the book are just horrific. And you really do a nice job of not just talking about the case that you were involved with and so successful on, but just sort of the history leading up to how we got here today with you know, this sort of systemic widespread discrimination by the U.S. Department of Agriculture in how they treated Black farmers.
Right. Well, I thought it was very important to have a background to compare and understand exactly where the history of Black farming came from. Obviously, one of the things that I learned is when the slaves left Africa, the only carry-on baggage they had was their knowledge of farming. And they came to America and made America really, through their labor, very successful, especially in the area of cotton. Well, these farmers or these slaves, once they had been emancipated, continued to do what they knew to do, which was farm. Then the government stepped in to prop up and make sure that the food market and food production would be available for everyone so that they would incentivize and subsidize if there was a drought or, you know, a flood or any type of issues, but also would provide loans for farmers to make sure that they were able to be productive and provide food for everyone here in America.
Yeah. So, and then let me give just a little bit of background in the case. And if I mess anything up, make sure you tell me, Greg. But so, as I said, I think the main name of the case that most people know by is Pigford versus Glickman. There's a case one and a case two. It's also known as In Re Black Farmers. And then a later case with Copeland versus Vilsack in the U.S. Department of Agriculture. But basically, back in 1997, there was a class action filed by a farmer named Timothy Pigford on behalf of 400 Black farmers for sort of widespread discrimination by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And this was basically, as Greg said, that there was loans that were available to farmers from the U.S. Department of Agriculture for various reasons, either for price support, for disaster relief, or for operating loans, things like that. In this process, there was sort of a tiered process that went through the county system, and it sounded to me, Greg, like overall that the, especially from 1981 through 1996, which was a time period that covered this class action, that system was especially controlled by white farmers or white politicians. And I think there was a statistic I saw where it was like less than 0.5% of the representation was black farmers in those.
Right.
And so basically you had discrimination by either, you know, outright denying loans or delaying loans, telling them that it had gotten lost in paperwork. There'd have to be applications filed 3 and 4 times. Sometimes just paperwork getting thrown in the trash can, or just being ignored. And this sort of, this went on up until 1996, and I'm sure it went on past that, but I think there was a report that came out in 1996 by the U.S. Department of Agriculture when they sort of enacted a civil rights component to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and that was the Civil Rights Action Team report, and found this this widespread discrimination. So the case started with 400 plaintiffs. During that case, they thought that it grew to as large as 2,000 members. Initially, that case was settled in 1999, and there was a time period for getting applications in. And there was basically a two-tiered process, or two tracks, I think. One, the first track was that basically if you could prove that you met the elements, then you could receive $50,000 plus some taxes, which I think amounted to about $12,500. Or you could go through a separate process that was a higher burden of proof, and you might be awarded an amount higher than that. And basically what happened was they learned pretty quickly, I think, that there were many more claimants than just 2,000. And there was a deadline that people had to get their applications in. Many, many, I think maybe like 30,000 people missed this deadline.
Right.
And so in 2008, there was a, under President Obama, there was $100 million put into a bill to basically sort of help people with this. They realized that that wasn't going to be enough. And so eventually there in 2010, I think there was another $1.15 billion added to that. And that basically resulted in the fund. And for what I think was a total of about 33,000 claimants received funds under this for a total settlement of $1.25 billion that Greg was lead counsel, part of a team of lawyers, but was lead counsel for these farmers, and just a tremendous result on behalf of them. So, Greg, I know I sort of went through that. Was that basically did I get the facts basically correct there?
I think you got everything exactly correct. I'm going to need the transcript of this because that's how I want to tell it. Next time. No, but you are very, you are right on point with that. Just a couple of things I'd point out is that, you know, the discrimination really started well before 1981.
Right.
The reason that there was a period of 1981 to 1996 was that there was going to be an exception to the statute of limitations in order to bring this cause of action, because we were going back 15 years. And the basis of that argument was that the farmers had been complaining and sending in complaints for many, many years. But when Ronald Reagan took over and became the president, he got rid of any of the civil rights offices that would normally addressed that, investigate it, and make a decision on it. So they were not in place for all those years. So our argument was that there was nowhere else to complain.
Right.
And now that we are going to complain, we just have to, you know, indicate that we had complained to someone in the local office.
Yeah. Yeah. And not to get too much into politics, but I think it's no secret that, you know, in 1996, when the civil rights component was put back into the Department of Agriculture, was when President Clinton was in office. And then basically when the second President Bush was in office, it didn't sound like much happened there. But then when President Obama came in, there was some relief for these farmers that was put back in place starting in 2008. So, like I said, Greg, I do want to talk about sort of the history here, but I first wanted to get into kind of Yvonne, I'll let you in on a little bit of my research skills. This is how good my research is. Is that I'm going to make a guess here, Greg, that your birthday is May 2nd, 1968.
And, absolutely, you got it right.
And that your father who worked at, you grew up in the Panama Canal zone, mm-hmm. and your father played your birthday in the lottery and won about $30,000
in 1968. Right. So you can imagine how much money that would be today.
That's right. So my question is Greg, is how does a kid who grows up in the Panama Canal Zone get involved in a case representing black farmers? And did you have farming in your background, and did you sort of learn about this, or how did that happen?
Right. No, I did not have farming in my background. And I can tell you that, you know, the impetus for that started with my upbringing in Panama in a very close-knit religious family, but also a family that tried to demonstrate to me and always tell me that, in fact, you know, that big things were expected and to dream big and that type of thing. So when we came to America, I didn't speak English as well as I probably should have at that point. So it was a bit of a struggle, but you know, at each step along the way, with every hurdle, someone was there to help me along the way. And it just caused me to develop a passion for helping those who are underserved, you know, those who can't speak for themselves.
Yeah. So one of the things that you, as I mentioned already, is, and I wanted you to touch on today is talk about, so, you know, after the Civil War ends, and we've actually talked on this show about this a little bit before when we visit some of the older civil rights cases. But after the Civil War, the idea was there was Reconstruction was put into place, and there actually were some steps taken to bring about closer to equality, African-Americans. And in fact, you tell the story, you know, the whole story of 40 acres and a mule that right. was promised to Black Americans after, during Reconstruction, was essentially this 400,000 acre plot of land from North Florida up to the southern part of South Carolina, all along the Georgia right. coastline. That was set aside so that African Americans could settle there, have a farm there, and basically get 40 acres and a mule, and that was when Reconstruction was going, and there was the Freedmen's Bureau, and there was things done to protect the rights of African Americans, and then essentially with Andrew Johnson. And I think it was the election of Rutherford B. Hayes and Samuel Tilden. There's a sort of deal made where they put Hayes into place, but they were going to pull the soldiers out of the South and let the South basically take back over. And at that point, right. you had a number of that's basically where Jim Crow comes from, where a number of discriminatory laws come from. I think there was the black codes that discriminated in both voting and working and ownership and just a number of things that were done to oppress black Americans. And then that sort of goes through. So there was this time period when they were able to farm, and then basically that was all taken away. And then that kind of gets us to where we are with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. So maybe I covered some of it, but I wanted you to talk a little bit about that link there.
No, absolutely, Steve. You know, the farmers, even when after emancipation, by the Emancipation Proclamation, they did what they knew to do and what they had done all their lives, which was farm. And now they would have to do it on their own without, you know, any support or whatnot. So it's really one of the tragedies that I think most people miss with this case is this really began the destruction of some of the greatest entrepreneurs here in America. These farmers were resilient, and they, you know, perfected their craft in farming. And despite many of the obstacles, continued to farm. And, you know, as late as 1920, 15% of all farmers were African-American, but they were providing about 30% of the food that was being eaten by Americans all over the country. So at that, but that group of people had been over the years were being attacked and being left out, essentially. The U.S. government, after the Emancipation Proclamation, understood that in order to have a strong nation, that you're going to have to ensure that we have a strong food supply. You can't fight a war if you're hungry. So they put in place systems that, you know, if you look at it in the abstract, they're actually, you know, the system itself is not necessarily discriminatory the way it is, but they put it in the hands of people who were former slave owners or those who, you know, had oppressed, you know, some of these former slaves. They put it in their hands to distribute that money. Well, you know what? I'd say all the time, look, there was a change in legislation, and that was the Emancipation Proclamation. But there wasn't a change of heart.
Right.
Those folks' heart did not change at all. So despite the fact that they couldn't freely hold the slaves or enslave the African-Americans anymore, they were still able to do it, you know, financially.
Yvonne, you know that the practice of law since the pandemic has started has completely changed.
Completely changed. A lot more pajamas involved for me.
Yes, yes, a lot more working from the computer, yes, and only getting dressed from the waist up. But you know who has helped that change and that transition immensely in our practice and can help everybody else in theirs is legal technology services.
That's right. I mean, being good at doing things virtually, at doing things through Zoom, through video conference, online, it's more important now than ever.
I'll say Zoom or WebEx or whatever you use now, Legal Technology Services has completely changed how they do things in order to get you organized, looking good. Our depositions, our hearings, our mediations have all changed. And a big part of that is because we do them all virtually and we're doing them with the help of Legal Technology Services. So they get our exhibits in order, you know, and you call up the exhibits by number, they'll highlight them, they'll enlarge them, they'll do whatever they want. And it actually flows really well. I do have to say, I think my depositions are more organized now than they were before the pandemic, because I used to just walk in with like a giant box of documents and then I'd pull out the documents and go through them. And now I'm much more organized because of Legal Technology Services.
Yeah. And I mean, LTS, I'm going to call them LTS because we're on a first name basis. You know, my favorite thing about them is that we work with them a lot. Their staff is really highly trained and you can always count on them to represent you well, whether they're doing your trial technology when we have in-person trials one day, or if they're handling your depositions, or they're doing settlement videos, other kinds of videos documenting stuff for you. You can always count on them to conduct themselves well. Clients like them, judges like them, courts like them, lawyers like them.
Yeah, the one thing that I have to say is when we're in trial, while I think we do pretty good in front of juries and hopefully they like us, they always like our trial techs, whether it's Bob, Taylor, Quentin, David, Liz, just any one of the people over there, they're all fantastic. And of course, Melanie, who runs the ship over there. But they do more than just exhibits. They do day in the life videos. They do settlement documentaries. They do demonstratives. And everything they do is just excellent. And you can look them up at ltsatlanta.com. And I can say that if you call them and tell them that you heard about them on the Great Trials podcast, then you get 10% off of your first service. So look them up at ltsatlanta.com. And I do want to say, even though they're based in Georgia, they do work nationwide. And I know they've done trials all over the country. But look them up at ltsatlanta.com.
I mean, I think one of the things that's really heartbreaking is that I think from a very surface level, if you read the facts of this case, then you're thinking about one type, maybe in a general sense of discrimination. You learn more about it. You're learning about how, you know, that they're not being treated equally, or their loan papers keep getting lost or whatever. But I think one of the things just reading about it that I don't, even though I should have made the connection, I probably didn't, but seems so heartbreaking, especially knowing this historical context, is that, you know, that these people, they have almost nothing. And what they have is their land that they're farming. But then as a consequence of how unfairly they're treated, they're having to give up that land. They're losing that land. I mean, that's heartbreaking. I think anybody can relate, but especially from a historical context, how important land ownership is.
Not only land ownership, but, you know, just generational wealth. That was something that was not going to be able to be passed on to the next generation. So, you know, many times the next generation would have to be starting over because the farm is lost and, you know, they have to go into a new type of job. So, yeah, I'm glad you picked up on that. Most people don't, but that whole concept of losing the land, the ability to pass that on to the next generation, and the value of that land is something else. It's kind of a byproduct, but it's certainly real and significant.
Yeah, I mean, I just think about, like, even in cases where people are compensated for their land, you know, in like eminent domain cases or whatever, where people are actually paid the money, but it's land they inherited, you know, from their grandparents or that's been in their family, and how hard, like in my hometown, how hard people fought this highway that was coming through. And it was just like the end of the world, losing these bits of land that they were actually getting compensated for. You know, meanwhile, these people are getting just ripped off at every turn. And then they're having to give that up. And then as you point out, the generational effects of that to come back from that is impossible.
Right. No, exactly. There's no way to get all of that land back that was lost over, you know, these tens of years. In addition to that, you know, it was kind of a destruction of the family as well, because, you know, what I've learned, I don't want to say I know, what I've learned in going out to rural America and talking to these farmers is about the family and how cohesive that family has to be, because in addition to whatever work or school they have to go to, everyone has chores. Everyone has chores, and everyone participates in the planting and the harvesting of these farms. And there's just a connection that is between, you know, families, brothers and sisters, mothers and fathers and their children, because of this hard work. Well, what would happen many times is when these kids went away to college, when a farmer worked hard enough and saved his money, and his child was fortunate enough to go to college and then had a college degree, the last thing they were doing was coming back to that farm. The last thing they were doing was going to come back to that farm, where they know that for years we've heard dad and mom complain about being treated unequal. So, you know, they would move away. And then a lot of times, because there's not, or there wasn't a focus on that generational wealth and the understanding of how important it is to have a will, what would happen is mom and dad die. Now there are five kids that have to split it. Well, you know, one or two of them have passed away, and they have three kids, and it's over here. And now you have probably 15 people who are not necessarily closely associated anymore, and trying to decide what to do with the plot of land. And what would happen a lot of times is they couldn't figure it out. Those families wouldn't figure it out. And someone would come in on a tax lien and acquire the land.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, as Yvonne was pointing out and Greg has talked to, you know, farming is a tough business no matter what. And that's why that the United States Department of Agriculture was sort of put in place to help out farmers, because, as Greg pointed out, that it's so important to keep our food supply there and to make sure that we can feed in time of war, or time of peace, or whatever. But, and then, you know, on top of that, these farmers had to face this discrimination where they were just met with a stone wall at every turn whenever they tried to get help that the government was saying that it was going to give to people, to the point that it caused a lot of these families to lose their farms or to get up to debt that, you know, would drown them. What I'd like to know, Greg, is, well, talk us through a little bit through the process of what was needed to prove, I guess, for a claimant in order to meet the Pigford merits. What were some of the stories that you heard, of some of these farmers that they had to go through?
Sure, sure. I'll tell you about the process. But let me say this first is, you know, I grew up in Orlando, Florida. And, you know, Orlando is not, it's not New York City, but it's not, you know, it's a more urban area. So I, you know, just being very honest here, when I initially heard the complaints of the farmers, and we were getting phone calls about whether there was going to be a second part of the case and were we representing folks or not, I didn't believe it. I couldn't believe that in, you know, 1981 to 1996, that this type of thing was actually happening. Now, you know, it's probably my, you know, me being naive to this, but I just really didn't believe it initially. And I said, well, that doesn't even sound like, that doesn't even sound plausible initially. And then ultimately I got a call from a set of brothers who were farmers, one in Texas, one in Oklahoma, who were telling me about their story and their farm and the development of their farm and how, in fact, they had been denied loans. And they were so adamant about it and so passionate about it. We had a phone call like on a Tuesday. By Thursday, they were in my office in Jackson, Mississippi.
Oh, wow.
In person. Because it was that important for them to have their stories heard and to ultimately get that out there. As you very eloquently described, Steve, the initial case, it was in 1997, and it was dealing with the discrimination from 1981 to 1996. The vast majority of the farmers who were aggrieved in this case missed the 6-month deadline that they had to file a claims form initially. So it's almost like it compounding what had already happened. Listen, we've been discriminated against you. Okay, here is, you know, kind of, here's an opportunity to be heard. And then, well, not really, you know,
yeah,
so.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So the vast majority of the farmers were not, you know, did not have their cases heard on the merits. So after a lot of advocacy, you know, there was that initial $100 million put in the 2008 farm bill, which was later added to reach the ultimate settlement. And part of the issue was to trying to identify the universe of potential claimants in this case. So many people had passed away. You know, sometimes the son or daughter of someone who has passed away may or may not know the facts that were necessary to prove the case. But there was a very detailed claims form that every farmer had to ultimately fill out and was adjudicated by a group of neutrals. And it included things, you know, obviously the address of the farm, what did you farm, when did you farm it, you know, how many acres did you have? Because, and I don't know all the answers to those questions, but it's like, you can't say you had 5 acres and you farmed corn because that doesn't work. You know,
right.
So there were certainly questions in there to weed out anyone who potentially was trying to game the system. And ultimately on the form, they had to also attest that they complained to someone, that they had given a complaint to someone and it did not go anywhere further outside of that local office. And, you know, one of the more poignant farmers that I met, I can recall, was in, I think, Hattiesburg, Mississippi. We were having a claims meeting, very, very well dressed, 2-piece suit. Farmer came in with his hat on, and he was elderly, so I didn't want him waiting in line. I decided to do his claims form myself, and he had all the answers. He had the name of the farm, you know, I mean, what he farmed, when he farmed, and you could just tell that. That this was very genuine, and he had all the right answers until we got to the end of the claims form. And I said, well, did you complain to anyone when they, you know, when you were be denied? And he looked at me, he said, no, I wouldn't give them the dignity. They were already mistreating me. I wouldn't give them the dignity of complaining. I said, well, sir, I get that, but you understand, unless you attest to the fact that you complained to someone, we can't say they were on notice of your issue and your claims form will fail. And he said, young man, where do I sign? And he would not attest to complaining. And, you know, he walked away that day with his dignity. And it made me realize that these farmers want to be heard, but they are very dignified people and very proud people. And it just kind of emboldened me in fighting for them.
Yeah. I was just thinking about that, about how many, you know, as many as you had that you were able to recover for, there must have just been thousands more who, why would they complain when everything they had heard was that you go complain and nobody does anything? So what's the use right. of it?
Right, right, right. And that's also one of the reasons that was that there was a notice issue in the first part of the case, and most farmers missed out on it. They just didn't really believe that, look, after all these years, after all this discrimination, after all this denial, okay, now they're really going to compensate us, really?
Yeah.
You know? Right, right. You have that level of feeling like you're like dealing with the DMV or whatever. And it's like, so your expectations right. are already low. But then on top right. of that, you've got this history of feeling very targeted based on your race and disrespected based on your race. So you're going to be extra like, okay, sure.
Right, 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 right. How is this going to hurt me? Not how is this going to help me, yeah. but how is this going to hurt me further?
Yeah.
Ugh. So, Greg, one thing I'm interested in, because and this is probably something that a lot of trial lawyers maybe are, you know, I mean, I think most trial lawyers understand that politics is involved in everything that we do, and you have to be involved in politics. But it seems like in this case, you had to really, not only are you having an advocate side with the court system, but you're also advocating on the political side, because you needed help from some legislators and eventually the president in order to get these farmers compensated. How do you handle the sort of the political side of this of representing these folks?
You know, this case was almost like a PhD program that was being launched on someone who had just, you know, probably gotten halfway through undergrad. It was very political. And, you know, I always understood, as any other trial lawyer, that how important politics are. But you really find out how important it is when you have some type of measure that you're trying to pass or to move forward. I had countless meetings with Congressmen and senators and other officials from the USDA, because it was there was a bunch of politics. And as you can suspect, everyone wasn't in favor of this settlement. Everyone wasn't in favor of it. There were those, I think it's Steve King out of Iowa, who was a big critic of this entire program. So we had to make sure that we were giving the politicians who were being supportive of us enough assurances that they wouldn't have egg on their face ultimately.
Mm-hmm. Right. So as far as the, so I know that under the two different tracks, there was either, if you met the elements, you would get this compensation of $50,000 plus this tax payment of $12,500. Talk about some of the cases that maybe fell under track B, where they were, what would you have to do on their behalf in order to get them a different amount of compensation, and meet this higher level of proof?
Right. You know, on the initial or on the track A claims, you just had to prove the elements of the discrimination. And the track B claim, you had to prove the elements, but you also have to prove up your actual damages, you know. And sometimes it's, I could have made X, but I, you know, I only made Y. And a lot of times those, just the documentation that is necessary to be able to prove that proved to be almost insurmountable. There were very few farmers who were successful in track B.
I saw something about, was there one farm, I think maybe even here in Georgia, that they may have received up to like $13 million for a loss that was, and I may be getting the facts a little bit wrong on that, but there was a sort of loss. And I read something about one of the farms where they received, I think maybe $13 million from
right,
the
right,
fund.
Sure. Shirley Sherrod, who was a big farm advocate then, and she's affiliated with that farm, was one of the very few farmers who actually received actual compensation for their losses. You know, again, these a lot of times these folks are farmers. They're not accountants, you know, so they may not have all the information or the sophistication that is necessary to enable to document this. No one ever thought, hey, let me document how much I really lost, because one day the government's going to come back and pay me for what I lost. So, that the track B proved to be very, very difficult.
Okay. So, let me ask you this. I've read that maybe the case is still ongoing. Are there still potential claims out there? And what do those folks need to do?
Right. Sure. No, there are no more. I mean, the case is actually closed. I'm still working on the case with some of the other lawyers because, you know, as in any class action, there's Cypre money left over, money that's left over after all the claimants have been paid, after all the bills have been paid. So we have, several years ago, we worked with Farm Aid and went through a process where we were able to distribute some of that money to a number of farm advocacy organizations. And now currently with the funds that we have left, we are working on different proposals, but potentially some type of financial institution that can serve as a bank or a lending institution for Black farmers.
So Yvonne, the internet is getting more and more crowded, especially ever since the pandemic, and it's getting harder and harder to get noticed online. And you can have all the great verdicts in the world, but if nobody knows about them, then they're not going to come and hire your law firm. So you need to find a company like Digital Law Marketing.
That's right. It turns out that what you put on the internet is no good if people can't find it. And Steve, we've talked about this, but now that I finally know what SEO is, which is search engine optimization, it's really important that your firm's site is maximizing the hits that it's going to get. And something that Digital Law Marketing is doing that's really cool right now is they're offering free SEO audits for law firm campaigns. So that's something our listeners should take advantage of.
Yeah, because it's hard to get around the internet and know how to make yourself visible without having somebody help you. And they are the experts in this. And not only will they help you design your website if you need to, they'll do your content marketing, they'll do your search engine optimization, as Yvonne just said, they'll do your pay-per-click marketing, social media marketing, and they also will offer full management on Google's new local service ads, which we just learned about and are trying to get into. But it's another way that you can put yourself out there and get people to know who you are. And Digital Law Marketing is great at it.
Exactly. And, you know, one of the things I think is cool is that you work with them and they really make you feel like they know your firm and they know you, and that they help you with your web presence so that it feels individual. It doesn't feel cookie cutter. It feels like they know the people at your firm and they get what you're trying to accomplish.
Yeah, it's not like they already have a website done and just give you one that's already been done, but they will spend time with you, get to know your personality, put your personality into the website, and you should go visit them at digitallawmarketing.com. That's digitallawmarketing.com.
Tell them we sent you.
This case makes me think of the broader topic of you know, reparations for what's been done to African Americans. Just, you know, over the centuries. And I guess I'm wondering, do you see any ties there? Do you see any potential hope for cases like that in the future of a reparations type case?
Sure. You know, words, as a trial lawyer, you know, words have power, and it depends on what words you use. I like to call it an investment in the Black community, because we're going to look forward here. We're going to look, you know, ahead as to what type of opportunities can be provided by some type of investment into the Black community. So I think there is a potential for that going forward. I believe that this case will be looked back upon as one of the seminal cases to indicate what a difference awareness makes. Now that the USDA acknowledged, now that, you know, the farmers had been heard, getting that story out to the general public, all of a sudden it's not, reparations don't sound as bad because you understand what one group of people have been through. So I think there is certainly a future for that. Look, even this last stimulus bill, there was $5 billion set aside for debt relief for Black farmers. Well, that was in response really to, you know, the previous 4 years, 0.1% of all the farm aid that went out, and we're talking about probably billions of dollars, went to Black farmers. The rest of it went to, you know, went to someone else. So in this last stimulus bill, there was an attempt to continue to right that wrong by giving the farmers some debt relief. And I believe that it's, you know, this is a direct correlation and a direct progression from the NRA Black Farmers case when Secretary Vilsack was in office and now is back in office again. And the fact that there's $5 billion put in the stimulus bill for that reason, I don't think it's coincidence. I think it's as a result of the previous cases.
Greg, I'm interested, and not to go negative, but when you think about what's happened and the historical effect of this discrimination, as we talked about how that deprives generational wealth and opportunities moving mm-hmm. forward that are lost because of that. You know, I'm interested how many of the farmers, you know, how they felt basically about their claims, about the claims resolution. You know, how much of them felt like, you know, something is better than nothing. How much of them felt like it was just, you know, as good as it was as a settlement, obviously, I mean, it's historic, that they felt, you know, it was, I don't know, I guess either not enough to address everything that they and their families had historically been through, or not. Or was it more about, you know, just the acknowledgement of the discrimination and, right. and the payment of those claims?
Right. I think that, you know, obviously when you're dealing with such a large group of people, the opinions are going to vary, obviously. But I think that, you know, what the farmers were most happy about was that awareness, that acknowledgement that, in fact, they had been wrong and that the government was essentially admitting that their complaints and what they've been through for so long was real. And it had a real effect on it. You know, the $50,000, it just depends on which farmers you talk to. Sometimes, mm-hmm. you know, many times it would be the estate of, you know, ex-farmer. So it was, you know, these kids were getting, you know, this influx of money. So, you know, some were happy, some were not. I think the general sentiment was, look, you know, it's not the value of what those 40 acres and a mule would have been, but it certainly was a beginning and a step in the mm-hmm. right direction towards correcting the past discrimination.
Well, it's certainly $50,000 in no way makes up for what has happened to most of these right. people, but it's certainly a huge step in the direction of justice. And I guess I'm just wondering, from your standpoint, somebody who's been involved with this so long, where do you see the future of obtaining justice for what's been done to, African-Americans in general and you know, more to be done on behalf of farmers or whoever else? I mean, what's the future hold?
Right. You know, I think, again, this is, I watched over the last year or so, and what has occurred with George Floyd and that type of that incident there. And what I realize is that it's awareness that is very important, both important to the farmers, but also to this case and the treatment of African-Americans in general or mm-hmm. Farmers, you know, the civil rights movement was being successful and making some gains, but it were very slow and small gains until the TV camera came on, mm-hmm. and the greater part of America saw dogs mm-hmm. and fire hoses, and then all of a sudden the opinion changed, because there was kind of this disconnect. But once that connection was made, this is American, this is what we're doing, the civil rights movement took off and really did a lot more. And I think that's going to be the same thing with this farming case, is that telling their story. I had a chance, I was honored to represent them in the courtroom and tell their story in the courtroom. But that's why I think it was so important for me to write this book, so that history is out there and there's an awareness by all Americans of the treatment that these Black farmers had received. And therefore, you know, it's much easier to be compassionate or be willing to invest in a group of folks when you understand what, in fact, they have been through.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Greg, this has just been a great discussion. I mean, this work is so important. It's not in any way finished, in my opinion. There's still a long way to go. But I mean, what you and your team accomplished in the case of Pigford versus Glickman and Ray Black Farmers is just tremendous. A $1.25 billion settlement on behalf of approximately 33,000 Black farmers. Is there anything else that you want to make sure that our listeners know about that case and about that representation that we haven't had a chance to talk about?
No, I think we talked about everything. I would just point out that, you know, the system isn't fixed. There still seems to be some disparity in terms of the support that the Black farmers are getting in this case. But also, I'd like, you know, just the listeners to understand how important farming is, you know, and what was really lost in this case. If you go back to, I think you mentioned, you know, after the Emancipation Proclamation, Black farmers were supposed to have the land between Charleston, South Carolina, and St. Augustine, Florida. Coastline. This is where this is very expensive property now. Expensive to live there now. What if those farmers had really been given that land and given the opportunity to govern themselves? You know, how would that be different? And how would, you know, the relations amongst everyone in America be different? So again, you know, I thank you for having me today and giving me an opportunity to share the stories of many farmers. You know, I tell people all the time, look, I come before you as one, but I stand as 10,000.
Yeah.
So I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today.
Well, you know, I do want to just give another shout out for the book. Again, it's called Just Harvest, and you can find it at justharvestbook.com. Some of the stories that you tell about in there that I guess I didn't even realize. I mean, or at least not from in a specific way, maybe as a general way, but is even after slavery is over, you know, and basically there's everyone is supposed to be free, that there was a system, you know, especially here in the South, where you know, either Black Americans would be charged with minor crimes or be put into some sort of debt situation where they would basically be forced back into a forced servitude where they'd be treated like prisoners and forced labor. Right. You know, and it's just something I hope, you know, Americans take the time to learn about and to read, because it's so important that we never forget that kind of stuff. But, you know, I think what you're doing, by making sure that, you know, not only did you get compensation for these farmers, but then telling the story of what's just happened over the years, is just so, so important.
Right.
Greg, before you go, I got to know, did you get any good farming tips or anything like that that you want to share?
Here's the best farming tip I got is, I used to, when I went out there, because I'd fallen in love with my clients and their life and whatnot, I used to want to be a farmer. Then I realized, no, I want to own a farm. I don't want to be a farmer.
That's right.
All right. That is a good tip.
That's fantastic. One other thing I wanted to say, and I'm going to tell you that my mother thanks you, because on your audiobook for Just Harvest, you got Wintley Phipps to read that. Yes. And if nobody knows who Wintley Phipps is, just a tremendous singer. Just a great voice. And I remember growing up, my mom playing his records around the house, and how much she loved him. And I think we even went to go see him a couple of times. But and he does such a tremendous job. I know my mother is always happy to hear, and I'm happy to hear about Wintley Phipps being used. He's a tremendous talent.
If you give me just 2 minutes here, I'll tell you a story about Wintley Phipps. Yeah. I really didn't. I was surprised and certainly honored when he agreed to do the audio book. So I sent him the manuscript and he started reading through it. And 2 days later, we'd had some phone conversations. We had been introduced by someone else. He called me and he said, listen, I know this story. I was like, what do you mean you know this story? He's like, I know this story. He said, listen, Greg, 30 years ago, I was a preacher in Washington, D.C. I had a church there and whatnot. And he said, There was a guy who used to come in, young guy who I think he was a politician. I wasn't sure at first. And he would just sit in the back of the church and he just looked very solemn. And one day I woke up and I said, you know what? I'm going to call that parishioner. I'm going to go over and sit and pray with him. And he did. That person was Mike Espy.
Oh, wow.
Mike Espy, who really is the person who got the, you know, this whole thing started when he was Secretary of Agriculture. And so just to be able to unite Mike and Whitley Phipps again, I mean, it was just a tremendous coincidence.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing. And we should say the foreword for Greg's book is written by Mike Espy.
Right.
So I think he was also your co-counsel on these cases.
He was the first person to really talk to me about the case, period. We had went to Mississippi to handle some donning and doffing cases at some of the chicken plants there and just decided to open an office there.
Yeah. Well, wow. Fantastic. Well, Greg, thank you so much for your time and thank you for talking to this and please keep up the tremendous work that you're doing. I want to remind everybody, we've been talking to Greg Francis, partner at Osborne and Francis PLLC down in Orlando and Boca Raton, Florida. And you can look them up at realtoughlawyers.com and at justharvestbook.com. Greg, thank you so much for your time.
But thank you, Steve. Thank you, Yvonne, for having me. I really appreciate it and enjoyed the discussion.
Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, have you reached a verdict?
Thank you for listening to the Great Trials Podcast. You can visit us online at greattrialspodcast.com. We realize in the show that sometimes we use terminology that not everybody would be familiar with, or that we haven't always explained every part of the jury trial process. So we've done two special shows, one on legal terminology, and Yvonne, that's going to be hopefully not that boring. We've included a number of people in that so that we can make that more entertaining, and a show on the jury trial process. And we've also put links to those episodes on our greattrialspodcast.com, as well as a glossary of the legal terminology on the website.
Yeah, so check those out. If you have a trial you would like to be featured on the Great Trials Podcast, or if you're a trial lawyer and you want to be on the show, or if you're just a person who has something that you want to say to us, please email us at info@greattrialspodcast.com. Note, if you have something mean to say, we don't have email.
Right, exactly. We only need positive commentary.
Yeah, we're fragile. Yeah. You can also rate or review us wherever you get your podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever. Again, if you have something mean to say, our podcast is not available for review.
We also want to thank the people behind the scenes. One is Taras Mischer, who is our podcast extraordinaire. He is from Podcast on the Go, and Allison Hirsch from Capricorn Communications. She is a magician when it comes to putting these shows together and getting them scheduled. And this has been the Great Trials Podcast, and we appreciate your time and hope you'll listen again.
Thank you for listening.